supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Later in the show, a timely question of the week. What do you do with summer blooming bulbs that need to be protected over the winter, like dahlias, tuberous begonias, canna lilies, and the like? We'll tell you, but mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens. So before we get to those important instructions, we're taking that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Joel, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Joel. How are you?
I'm okay. How about you?
I am doing just fine, sir. And where is Joel okay?
I'm in Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania.
Okay, very good. Just outside of Philadelphia. What can we do for Joel in beautiful Huntington Valley?
Well, I've been a listener to your show for about a year now and gotten all kinds of great information in practice at my new home. I've been cutting my grass at 3 inches, and it's looking healthier than ever. And I've been collecting tons and tons of fall leaves from all my neighbors' curbs. And I decided to put your claim to the test about never having too much leaves in the fall. And I found a landscaping company who was collecting leaves in my neighborhood, and I had them dump two big, huge truckloads in my driveway of really well-shredded leaves. And now I have about half the size of the driveway that I did before, but I'm rubbing my fingers together, just looking forward to all the good compost I should have in the spring.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, do you have a big home? Do you have a house with a big lot?
I live on about a quarter of an acre, I'd say. I've already got a couple of piles going, and I'm not really sure where I'm going to be able to put all these leaves, but I'm going to try and find some place. And I'm kind of wondering, how much should I expect these leaves to shrink down, and how quickly? And also, if I'm going to add coffee grounds and things like that, how much am I going to need for a pile this big? So if you have any ideas, that would be great.
Now, all the leaves are shredded, right?
Yes.
Okay. Are they clean? You're sure there's no grass clippings or other stuff mixed in there?
Yep, perfectly clean and really finely shredded.
Really finely shredded. And are we talking about a pile the size of a compact car, let's say?
No, it's maybe two compact cars.
Ooh, okay. So we're talking a big pile. And what kind of a garden do you have?
I have about, I guess, the equivalent of 8 4x4 raised beds.
Oh, okay.
And I have, a few beds on the side for herbs and things like that.
Do you have areas on your property where you can set up satellite compost bins?
Yeah, I have a couple areas. I mean, I have a roll, one of those tumbler bins, and I have a small pile that's shaded on one side of the house that takes a long time. I usually just kind of have been storing the leaves over there. And then I have another pile that's bigger that I turn pretty frequently on the sunny side of my garage.
Right. So what I would do is, you've got this stuff in place, I would start figuring out where the satellite piles are going to go. And as you move it in between now and when you start doing that, find a good source of coffee grounds. I mean, go around to the local Dunkin' Donuts, the local Starbucks, even the supermarkets are making coffee. I mean, I've been getting the coffee grounds here from WHYY. They change out the machine once a week, and I get what our engineer Al thinks is like 25 pounds of grounds. And boy, it just disappears, because I have a pile of leaves about the size that you do. And I've mixed in, probably 4 or 5 of those bags already, and I'll probably do some more. The more coffee grounds you mix in with the leaves, the faster they are going to compress in size, the faster they're going to become finished compost, and the less you will have to turn them. You'll see that the piles will heat up very well. So you're going to be rewarded for this. In the meantime, you know, do what you can to get them out of the way. The more you contain them inside wire bins, the better they're going to do. And mix them real well with coffee grounds. The more you mix in the coffee grounds and these well-shredded leaves, I think you'll probably be combining piles by the time we get to February. Mm-hmm. And then in the spring, you'll see it'll be reduced greatly in size. That's when you'll separate out the material. There'll still be a lot of shredded leaves on the top and the sides, but the bottom, the part that you won't see until you get to it, will be beautiful black compost. So you'll fill up your beds with that. You'll make a couple more raised beds. You'll give some away. And the leaves that are still leaves, you can use those as mulch on top.
Wonderful.
All right, Joel. I'm so glad that you dove in head first. That's a great way to garden.
All right. Sounds great. I'm looking forward to the results.
Oh, you're going to love it. Take care, man.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Malia, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Yes, sir. Hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Am I getting your name right? Malia?
Yes, sir. That's right.
Okay. Very good. And where are you, Malia?
In Henderson, Texas.
Whoa. Okay. Very good. What can we do for Malia in the state of Texas?
Well, I have four ivies, two big ones, two small ones, mm-hmm. and one on top of my refrigerator. And I don't know how to take care of them. I get so much advice, do this, don't do this, ignore them. My husband is convinced they have spider mites, but I don't know. I don't know. I got them. They were really full and beautiful. Now they're not like that. They're growing. They put runners, but I don't know what to do for my ivies, and I want to keep them living. I don't know what to do.
Okay, so you have ivy as houseplant.
Yes.
Ivy is a rambunctious grower outside, but it needs pretty special conditions indoors to really flourish as a house plant. They really like bright light. Is the one on top of the fridge right up against a light or something?
What do you call those lights? Fluorescent? The two
right.
long bulbs? That's what's shining on it.
Okay, so that you lucked out on the light. What about the other ones? What kind of light are they getting?
They're in the window. I just open the Venetian blind and let the sun kind of get on them.
Okay.
Indirect from outside.
Okay, stop doing that. Have you noticed that that's yellowing the leaves?
Yes, they don't like it.
Right. This is the weird thing in my business. They use these terms that almost seem impossible to achieve, one of which is really bright light but no direct sunlight. So with Venetian blinds, that's very tough to achieve. What people generally do is they find a spot where there's like sheer curtains that let mm-hmm. a lot of the light through but block that direct sunlight.
Right.
And they like it cool. So a lot of times they suffer in a hot, dry house over the winter time. So they would want to be in your coolest room. They like high humidity. And one thing, if any of your ivies do have spider mites, one thing you can do for all of them that they'll love is spray them every morning. Really mist the leaves down. They absolutely love that. Keep them as cool as possible. Don't let them sit near a heat source, for instance. Don't let them sit near a radiator or a heat vent or anything like that. And bright light, but not direct sunshine. See, that's why I was a little surprised by the fact that the one on top of your fridge is doing so good, because typically right on top of a fridge is where the warm air from the compressor comes up the back.
Right.
So.
It's doing great.
Well, and.
But it's in a cup. It's just in water.
Oh. Oh, well, so you haven't rooted it yet.
No.
These are just, are the others rooted?
Yes, sir. They're in dirt.
Okay.
All the rest of them.
So what are you waiting for?
I don't know. Do any of it.
So how long have they just been rooting in the water?
About maybe 2 months.
Okay.
2 months.
So, and have you looked in the bottom of this cup? Because it's all filled with all these white roots, right?
Yeah, a whole lot of them.
Well, you got two choices here. Since it hasn't died, you can go out and get more of a decorative water container if you want. And just let it grow like that with the roots trailing down in the water. And as
okay.
long as it thrives, you don't worry about it. But the roots might be too long and weak now to actually plant up. See, because
okay.
if you're going to root ivy, it's fine to put it in water for like a week, let it develop some starter roots. But it's very tough to take those watery roots and, you know, get them into soil to get them to adapt to the different conditions. But there's nothing wrong with having fun and just growing it. And because you say it's even sending out runners and everything.
Yes, it looks beautiful.
Yeah. So the others, you want to get them brighter light. You want to mist them every morning. You want to make sure their soil doesn't dry out and keep the temperatures cool. And especially if you think you have spider mites on a plant, just spray it. Just spray it with plain water. That's all you need to do. They can't stand humidity. And if a leaf turns yellow or looks bad or something like that, just pull it off. Just cut it off. That's how we make people think we're good gardeners. We pull off all the bad-looking leaves.
It's not full as it used to be. I mean, there's a lot of leaves, and it grows leaves.
Right.
But there, it does not look like – it looks like a fro. When I first got it.
Yeah. Okay, like, so it's getting more sparse?
Very sparse.
That's lack of light. Give it more light and you'll get more leaves. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. I appreciate it. I love your show.
All right. Well, thank you. You take care.
Yes, sir. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that we still have a few openings left in the tour I'll be leading to investigate the botanical delights of Cuba. And maybe, just maybe a little bit, enjoy the 80-degree daytime temperatures they get there from January 14th to the 22nd. But don't go looking for all the details in the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to protect your tender summer-blooming bulbs over the frigid winter. I'm Frigid Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, an important and timely topic. Have you had a light frost and you're waiting for your ground to freeze hard? Well, if you've got dahlias, cannas, or tuberous begonias in that ground, you might want to try to save them. We'll tell you how to safely get them out and how to safely store them for next year. After lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Jackie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, let me start out by saying I love your show. It's always so informative. I try to never miss you.
Well, thank you, Jack. That's very kind of you to say. And where are you?
I'm in Mansfield, Louisiana, which is the northern part of Louisiana.
So what can we do for Jackie in Louisiana?
My question is, I have a lot of clay around, and I have been looking like at the fescue grasses. I want to know which grass to plant, like on a hill, because I have washing. And, you know, I have the clay, but I always fill the hole in with, like, good soil and stuff like that. But I want a pretty grass, like different varieties of grasses that don't get any more than, like, 12 inches, 15 inches tall.
Oh, okay. So you're not talking about planting a lawn. You're talking...
I want, like, ornamental grass, like the fescue.
Well, fescue is actually a broad term that applies to one of the most popular cool season lawn grasses. But
what I'm trying to do is I want pretty grass. I'm not grass, but like ornamental, like, you know, like that I could put 5 or 6, 7 on a hill and they would also help with my wash problem.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There are huge varieties. There's entire books about ornamental grasses. Now, why do you want to keep them so low?
First of all, I'm putting them like around my building. I built a new building for my shop, and I kind of like up on a hill. So I want them to not only be pretty, I want them to make sure that it doesn't wash. So I really want something that's decorative and that will live here through the winter, even though, you know, we have mild winters.
Oh, no, you're not going to. Ornamental grasses are tough, Jack. Ornamental grasses are one of my favorite answers for problem areas. I think you're right on the money, and you are going to be amazed. There are hundreds of different types that fit your descriptions and fit your needs.
That's what I want.
You mentioned the word fescue. Does that mean you've looked at blue?
I have been looking. Yeah, I love the blue that I saw online, that Elijah Blue, but I wasn't sure that would live here through, you know, if I can plant it and it will come back every year.
Now, Jackie, you're acting like you're in Minnesota or something.
I know. I mean, it's not cold at all, but
No.
No.
The only issue is some of these grasses may need a little bit of supplemental watering in hot summers, but Louisiana is also famously damp.
Right.
So you don't get a lot of droughts. No, I think you can choose what you like. Yeah, there is a wide family of ornamental grasses called the blue fescues. And as you said, you know, they're going to be Elijah Blue and Rock and Roll Blue. And,
Okay.
Yeah, there's a blue. The basic blue fescue grows to 1 foot high and 10 inches wide. Come on, can of corn. That's exactly what you said, right?
That's perfect. That's exactly what I want.
Yeah. Now, if you've got a lot of clay, you know, before you put them in, till up the soil and do a little something to improve the drainage, mix in some compost or something like that. But these are really tough plants. The only thing, you know, because your summers get so hot so quickly, don't delay. Install them sooner, earlier in the spring than later.
Okay, I was going to try to put them in this fall if I could.
Perfect.
Can I do that?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, the survival rate is going to be much better.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate everything, and you've been more than helpful.
All right. Well, thank you, Jackie. You have a warm winter.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Sally, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine, Sal. How are you?
I am good.
And where is Sally good?
I am good in Westchester, Pennsylvania.
A beautiful area out there. What can we do for you?
Okay, well, what I'm looking to do is to encourage our homeowners association in the townhouse development where I live to think about switching to organic lawn care, or at least using fewer chemicals than they're using now.
Right.
So at this point, they're using two different kinds of fertilizer and a very smelly herbicide.
Ooh. And,
yeah. Which I shoo them off my portion of the lawn, which is a tiny victory. But I think that there are folks on the board now who might be open to looking at alternatives. And so I'm looking for resources on regimes to replace the chemicals. And I know some of that is the way we mow and other things. And then also examples of places that have done this. because I think that they think that there aren't any. And I'd like to show them some examples.
Not only are there many examples of these homeowners associations and communities that have switched to either organic or more sustainable lawn care very successfully, but there are even golf courses that are following this trend now. And golf courses have the best excuse of all to, quote, use chemicals, right, because they, to make the game play correctly, they often have to care for the grass in a way that doesn't lead towards sustainability. There's areas they have to cut much too low, for instance. So even they have learned how to do this. Now, there's a couple of keys here. Obviously, part of this is political. It's getting enough support on your side. One resource I would turn you on to is a website called safelawns.org.
Okay.
So that has a lot of examples of these kind of communities that have switched over. Also okay. has a lot of horror stories about what happens with all this spraying. But it certainly can be done, but it needs to be done in kind of a holistic manner. They can't cut the grass down to a half an inch and expect it to thrive. They can't overfeed it and expect it to thrive. And the people doing the work, they're getting paid to come out and do things. So there is always that issue of getting them to accept the same money but not come out as often.
Well, I'm hoping, too, that part of this can be an economic question. If we can look at our contractor and say we want to save money and have a healthier lawn, I think the board would be for making a smaller line item for landscaping.
And do you know when their contract comes up?
I'm not 100% positive whether it's winter, because they may also have the shoveling contract. So
right.
No. Contract. So at this point, I just want to get it into the mix for whatever cycle.
Right. Well, one thing you want to do is find out what kind of a contract they have, look over the contract, see how it's spelled out, when it renews, and stuff like that. And, you know, somebody has to talk to the guy who runs the landscaping service. Years ago, I was actually hired by a community just outside of Princeton, Lawrenceville, New Jersey, to do exactly this, to come up with a lawn care plan that would be more sustainable than the one they currently had. And we were so lucky, because the guy who had the lawn care contract could not wait to work with me. He was desperate, because he feels that this is the new way of the world, and he wanted to learn how to do this correctly, and he was tired of using the chemicals. So if you've got that will on the other side, it becomes really easy. You know, one thing that is on your side are the laws. You know, many states have now passed laws that severely limit the percentage of nitrogen that can be in fertilizers,
right,
that absolutely prohibit phosphorus in lawn fertilizers,
right,
unless a soil test shows it needs it. And, you know, Pennsylvania is surrounded by these communities. Jersey has laws, Virginia and Maryland. Maryland just passed a great law. Virginia's going to follow suit real soon.
And maybe if we were located in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, we'd have tougher regulations on this.
Yeah, but you're near the Brandywine. I mean, everybody.
We're in the Delaware, yeah.
Everybody's got a watershed. So go to Safe Lawns, and eventually these things had to be legislated. So, you know, that's one overriding way to look at it.
Right.
If it's legislated, they have to do it. But read the contract, find out what you're up against, stir up support in the community, and I believe safelawns.org will help you out with material. I know Paul Tukey, the guy who's the head of Safe Lawns, he'll even come out and give a presentation to your homeowners association.
Oh, that would be great.
Because he wants to get every lawn in America off of chemicals. And the dirty little secret of lawn care is none of these things are necessary. A
right.
couple of gentle feedings a year, a nice high cut that's correct for the type of grass. There's no need for herbicides or chemicals,
right,
but, you know, there's a lot of money being made in applying these things.
Yeah, I agree.
So,
well, that's great. It looks like everything's all in one place. So I think you might have saved me a whole bunch of time bashing around the internet. So I appreciate that.
Yes, that's a good starting resource. But know this, that it works. It can be done.
Yeah.
It's very easy. You just need political will.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Sal.
Okay. Thank you, Mike.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Patrick, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike.
Hello, Patrick.
How are you?
Good. How are you, sir?
Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for making it. Where are you, sir?
Greenville, Tennessee.
Oh, right. Very good. What can we do for Patrick in Tennessee?
I'm contemplating getting a lot. However, it's a very wet lot, and it does, from time to time, flood. However, it's a transit thing. It tends to have a water table maybe about 3 feet down from the surface. And I'd like to know what type of fruit tree might I put in there, because the lot cannot be used really for a home or anything like that.
Well, I got no good news for you, Patrick. Yeah, you know, there are fruit trees that are very delicate. There's fruit trees that are very hardy. There's other fruit-producing plants, lower plants, like, you know, blueberries and blackberries and raspberries that are deemed to be bulletproof and easy to grow. And the line you'll always read in gardening books is, except for wet feet. None of these plants can survive wet feet. I guess you're thinking about apples, peaches, pears, things like that.
Yeah, traditional is what I was thinking, or figs.
Yeah. The problem is these are all disease-prone plants to begin with. Staying wet would weaken them, but the flooding would outright kill them. It is the opposite situation of what you want with fruit trees. You really want an area where there can be air circulation and low humidity. If you think about these wet spots, you don't see many natural fruits growing in it. Now, oddly enough, the reference I'm using says that some of the brambles can survive wet feet, which is the opposite of what I grew up being told, that, you know, for instance, the only thing that can kill raspberries is poor draining soil. But there may be low fruits like raspberries, raspberry relatives, that could survive in this soil. There's amazing plants you could grow there. It sounds like this is the perfect situation for cypress trees, bald cypress, pond cypress. I think I was once told that of all the plants that we use in horticulture and commerce, less than 5% of them really thrive in situations like this where the soil is wet and floods repeatedly. It's a very small selection of plants, but fruit trees ain't one of them. There are some smaller fruits, again, that you might be able to get by with, some of which feed people, some of which feed wildlife. Elderberry. You could grow elderberries. Elderberries are not only nutritious, they are felt to be one of the most true antivirals that humans can consume. You eat a bunch of elderberries, you'll never get a cold or a flu. That's better than an apple for you.
Is it high in antioxidants, I guess?
Antioxidants and an actual antiviral compound that's not found in any other plant. There is a botanical medicine called Sambucol. The name of the elderberry plant is Sambucus. It's also sold under that name. And this is a naturally occurring antiviral compound that in studies has been shown to be as effective as any of the prescription antivirals. It would grow very well. Go ahead.
Is the elderberry a tree or a shrub or a bush?
It's kind of all three. It's kind of a shrubby, bushy kind of tree that you can train. There's different forms of it. You can make elderberry wine. You can eat fresh elderberries. You could sell your elderberries to people who make nutritional supplements and retire early. Especially if you're in a hurry, you would start off with plants. And what you would do is you would search the word elderberry, or if you want to be scientific about it, Sambucus. And you'll find that there are a lot of different named varieties that all have different characteristics. Some are stunningly ornamental, as well as good producers of berries. And one of the nice things about these smaller plants that produce true berries as opposed to stone fruits like peaches and apples is that they're going to produce their fruits much faster after many fewer years. You know, with an orchard, you got to wait 5-6 years, depending on the size of your original trees, before you got anything to eat. But if you want to do an elderberry farm, that would be crazy wild good. If you start with big plants, I think you'd be getting fruit the second year.
And I'm pretty well sold on the elderberry.
I think it's going to work out great for you. And stay in touch and let us know how it works out.
No, I'll do that.
All right.
It may be a year or two, but I'll be back in touch.
All right.
Thank you so much, Mike.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Good luck to you, sir.
Bye-bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and warn everyone who falls in love with one of those little fabulous rosemary Christmas trees you see this time of year that there's a trick to keeping them green. Those little, quote, trees are pruned down to that merry little shape from big honking shrubs. But retailers want to keep the pots small and the total package light, so these things are severely root-bound. There's very little dirt in there. So as soon as you get it home, move it into a pot twice as big, filling in the bottom and sides with compost or a high-quality potting soil, and that's a rosemary tree that'll stay green through Christmas. But don't you go rescuing your rosemary just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and how to safely care for your summer-blooming bulbs over the non-summer. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and offers gift certificates, both traditional and e-cards, that can help make holiday giving easier. Burpee gift certificates are available online at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week: how to protect your dahlias, canna lilies, tuberous begonias, and other summer blooming bulbs when it ain't not summer out there no more. We'll tell you how to keep them alive for year after year after year. After a couple more, your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Alice, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Alice. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. And where is Alice Great?
We live in Narberth, PA, just outside of Philly.
Very good. What can we do for Alice in Norbeth?
Well, I was wondering about some trees that we have on our property. We just moved there, and it seems like the trees have been neglected for a while. So we called up a tree company and asked them about pruning our trees. And they actually came last Friday and trimmed some dead branches out of two of the trees in our yard.
Now, you called the arborist because you saw the dead branches?
It just seemed like the tree was really overcrowded.
You know, when you talk about pruning trees to keep the centers open and stuff, you're mostly talking about like fruit trees and real disease-prone trees. What are we talking about?
This is a sugar maple.
Typically, such a tree would not be pruned, and this would be a terrible time to prune living branches. But you said they came out and identified dead branches and only removed those?
That's what they said.
Okay, well, that's excellent. That would be that would be good arborist, because you were kind of leaning into them to thin the tree out now, right?
Yes, I think that's what my husband wanted.
Yeah, and that would have been the wrong thing to do for the trees, although you should always remove dead, diseased, or heavily damaged branches as soon as it's noticed. And why do you think these things need to be thinned?
It just seems to be providing more shade than I think we were hoping to have.
You can occasionally increase the amount of sunlight that hits an area by thinning out some portions of a tree. Now, it has to be done in the dead of winter, especially with maples. That's the only safe time to prune them. And you can never remove more than one-third of the tree. How much sun did you want to get through, and what do you want to achieve?
We were having trouble with the amount of grass that was growing in our backyard, and we're hoping that we could grow some grass back there.
Well, there's two issues here. First of all, you realize the shade of the trees is incredibly valuable in keeping your property cool during the summertime. The second part is people often misunderstand why grass doesn't grow well around trees. Part of it is the shade thrown by the tree, but a lot of it has to do with the competition of the root system of the tree. Trees are bullies, so they're always going to take the most nutrients. They're always going to take water first. They're always going to take food first. So it's a very delicate balance. Plus, if the tree is throwing a lot of shade, there's only a couple of very specific type of grasses that can do well under there, and those grasses don't take a lot of foot traffic.
Right. I'm concerned about the health of the tree overall, because the tree company indicated that they thought it might have carpenter ants, but they didn't give us a definitive yes or no, or how to proceed with investigating that and or treating that if it's true.
Well, they did. They treated it already. Carpenter ants are often doing you a favor. If you have carpenter ants in a tree, it's because there's dead parts of the tree. So if the tree company removed all the dead branches, the carpenter ants will move on to their next union job. There's like nothing nothing left for them to do there. Now, how long have you lived in the house?
2 months.
Oh, okay. You will learn the health of the trees in the springtime. First of all, if you've been in the house for 2 months, you got plenty to do, right?
You're right.
Come on, look at these windows. Are we going to remodel this bathroom? And you're looking at trees? Come on, look at the carpeting down here. Jeez, we got so much to do. So what you're going to do is you're going to watch how these trees leaf out in the spring. And if they leaf out beautifully and put on a good display of leaves, especially now that the dead branches have been removed, then those are healthy trees. If they don't leaf out really well, then maybe they're at the end of their life and you need to think about removing them. But really, if you want a lawn, your long-term answer would probably be to plan to get rid of the trees next summer and install a real lawn at the end of August, early September. But the mizzamez, half a half, you wind up with thin trees and a thin lawn.
Great.
In the meantime,
okay,
get to work on those kitchen cabinets. Come on.
Yes, sir.
All right,
thank
Alice.
You.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. David, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, David. How are you, sir?
I am great. I'm in Franklin, Tennessee, in Williamson County.
What can we do for David in Franklin, Tennessee?
Well, I had called to tell you about my situation with tree leaves.
Okay.
And composting. I have a 2,000-square-foot garden, and I end up with a pile that's maybe 6 feet high and, 20 feet across. Over time, I hit them with the mulching lawnmower.
Good, good, good.
And just go keep on and eat at it until I finally get it down to a powder. And, boy, my soil last year was just incredible. All full of worms. I till them in very, very gently. But you have said avoid tilling, and I understand that, and I do have a weed problem.
Oh, okay. Now, you are putting together this gigundous pile of leaves, but rather than just allow it to compost and using the compost, or rather than use the shredded leaves as a mulch, you're tilling the powdered leaves into the soil?
I'm only going down in maybe an inch, like I say, just enough to mix dirt in with the powder.
And what's your scientific reasoning there?
Then that's to introduce microbes and stuff, or that was my thinking. Plus, then it sits there for 6 months until winter's over.
And as you already acknowledged, however, even that little bit of tilling is exposing dormant weed seeds to light and stimulating them to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you plant them and you feed them and you water them.
Well, I definitely held back. I did one-tenth of the tilling that I have done in previous years from listening to your show.
Excellent.
Are you saying that you think that the leaves, if I just leave the powder there and they'll just catch the rain and snow and rot on their own, I don't need to mix them with the soil?
Oh, correct. Correct. Yeah. Now, do you have raised beds or are you a flat earth garden?
I'm flat earth. In, say, 2,000 square feet.
So,
and I do have timbers around it.
Okay, so what I want you to do is I want you to experiment with creating some spaces that are no wider than 4 feet. And they can be as long as you want, but you don't want to step in those areas. That's the only reason you have to till is you've compacted the soil with your big clunky feet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So even if you don't want to build raised beds, just put up stakes and string.
To
indicate areas that you're not going to step in. And then you can use your leaves one of two ways. It's always smart to take some of your shredded leaves at this time of year, in the late summer, early fall, even winter, and use them to cover your raised beds. It'll prevent any nutrient loss. It protects the soil from extreme temperature changes. And as you've noticed, earthworms colonize underneath leaf litter. You may have thought you had a lot of earthworms before. If you just put the leaf litter on the surface of the soil, you will get five times as many earthworms.
Wow.
Because
that's what I needed to hear. You just saved me a good 5 hours of tilling and $5 worth of gas.
There you go. And not to mention the weed pulling afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, when you get to the bottom of this humongous pile, even if you've added nothing to it, even if it hasn't been sitting there for that long, you're going to have a massive amount of rich black compost. And you can use that first to mulch any disease-prone plants you have, like roses, lilacs, and tomatoes. And when I do my pepper plants or tomato plants, I will dig a hole. I'll drop the tomato plant into the ground. Now, on top of that, I'll put some crushed eggshells to provide calcium.
Oh, okay.
But then I'll just fill in with the soil that's around them, and then the compost will go as a mulch on the surface of that bed.
Oh, I see the difference, of course.
Every time it rains, compost tea is draining down slowly to the roots of that plant. And then your other beds, you cover them with 2 inches of shredded leaves. Earthworms will have parties underneath them. You'll be doing less work. You'll have better results.
I see. So maybe I'm going overboard with my powdering because I really get it down to dust before I'm done with it.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that, man.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
It has been a pleasure.
All right. Right here, too. You take care, David.
Thank you.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Storing dahlias and other summer-blooming bulbs over the winter. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please read us this week's oh-so-timely question.
Well, Mike, we heard from Leah in Bowlesburg, Pennsylvania, which she describes as being in the middle of the state. She writes, "What is the proper way to dig up and keep dahlia tubers for the next season? I love your show." Thank you, Leah. Now, Mike, aren't dahlias just one of a fairly large group of, quote, summer-blooming bulbs that need to be dug up, brought inside, and protected for winter?
Yeah, and every one of these plants is a little bit different. Practically the only thing they have in common is that none of them are true bulbs. They grow from roots, corms, rhizomes, and other underground structures.
Now, how do you care for yours over winter?
Well, with dahlias and tuberous begonias, I just cheat, because cheaters always win. I grow them in hanging baskets, and then I bring them inside to hang in sunny windows before it gets really cold outside. If you've got the space, they make great houseplants.
But if they're in the ground...
Then yes, you have to dig them up and store them. Unless you live in a zone where that specific plant can survive winter under a heavy mulch, or you don't mind buying new plants every spring, which a lot of people do. Now, a fellow garden writer I consulted, Marie Iannetti, warns that there is no definitive way to do this. Every gardener has their own little style. The most important guidelines, she notes, are to keep the stored roots in an area that won't freeze, not to seal them up in airtight containers, because they'll rot if you do, and to check them a few times during the season.
Check them for what?
For the bad one. Same as with apples and potatoes. If you got 8 dahlia tubers in a box and one starts to get all soft and mushy, frequent checking will allow you to get that bad boy out of there before it infects the others.
But what about the actual digging up part?
Well, for dahlias, Marie says to allow frost to kill the tops of the plants, but to dig the roots up before the ground freezes hard. Then pack the roots in cardboard boxes filled with slightly damp peat moss and store those boxes in a place that ideally stays between 40 and 50 degrees. Now, dahlia tubers don't like to dry out completely, so check them every month or so and mist the peat moss lightly if it seems dry. But don't overdo it. We're not watering the plants. We're just keeping their humidity up a bit.
And those big, beautiful tuberous begonias?
Pretty much the same. Let frost kill the tops back, but dig the roots up before the soil freezes hard. Let them cure in a dry, airy spot for a few days, and then pack them in a cardboard box filled with peat moss. But keep these roots more on the dry side.
So that's it?
Well, there's lots of other summer-blooming bulbs. Canna lilies, for instance, are one of the hardiest. They can often survive being left in the ground under a heavy mulch in protected areas in zones 7 and up. But if you don't want to risk losing them, they're also the easiest to overwinter. You just wrap them up in newspaper and store them in boxes. But with all this stuff, the devil is in the details. For instance, it's really important to get the roots out of the ground without damaging them. The best way to do this is to use a garden fork or pitchfork to slowly work the soil a good foot away from the base of the plant. Take your time, keep forking down lower, and ideally you'll be able to lift all of the root system out of the ground without injury. Don't rush this step. Any little nicks or cuts could mean a rotten bulb in February.
But then what do? Wash them off?
Well, some people do, but I don't. I think it greatly increases the chance of their rotting while they're in storage. I prefer to just let them sit out in a cool, dry spot for a few days, gently brush away any dirt, then carefully trim off the tops. Any old greenery you leave would turn into a mold-inducing mush in storage. Then I let them sit for a few more days to seal and heal, and then I examine them again. If there's a few bad-looking sections, I prune them off and let the wounds heal for a few more days. But if large parts of a bulb are soft or rotten or damaged, just toss the whole bulb.
And then you box up the good ones.
You know, the hardest part is often finding the ideal storage area for those boxes. You need temps that stay below 50 degrees, but that don't drop below 40 degrees. You have to use cardboard or something else that can breathe, and you have to protect the boxes against mice. Hungry mice love to try and get at stored bulbs. So I put a few traps around mine, and I check them frequently.
Not me. That's why I have a husband.
Ah, yes. Dead animal disposal is one of the top spousal attributes for most men.
Okay, so anything else?
Yeah, everyone has to remember that this is the art of gardening, not a science. There's a lot of different ways to do this. And you may have to experiment for a few years to get your perfect technique down. And even then, you're going to have the occasional plant that won't make it. Just be proud of any success you achieve, and be happy that in gardening, you can go out and replace your failures. Well, that sure was some good information about storing summer blooming bulbs over that time period when it ain't not summer no more now, wasn't it? Luckily for those of you who want more details, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to pack me in a thin box and slather it with peanut butter if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org.
Please, please, please tell us where you live. Please.
And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, audio of past shows, and our podcast. Elizabeth Perez Lunes, executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Adam Stanishevsky. Shevsky, 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 what a wine. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's internet illuminators. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and see what's new every day at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Our well-protected staff includes editor Al Banks, production assistant Effie Kong, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. If I'm lucky, they'll blow some leaves over top of me and wish me luck over winter. But I'm a tough old bird, and I'll see you next week. Ha! Are invasive plants really invasive, or just the next wave of natural selection? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss the wild things with Professor Karen Snetzlar, plus your fabulous phone calls.